Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI, William Faulkner. Just saying the name brings up these really strong images, doesn't it? The Deep South, these sprawling, complex family stories and sentences that just, well, they go on forever. Today, we are diving deep, really deep, into what many critics think is his absolute pinnacle, the 1936 novel Absalom. Absalom.
It really is something else. More than just a book, it feels like an archaeological dig. Faulkner, you know, Nobel Prize winner, he was a master of that modernist fragmented style. But his real power here, I think, is wrestling with this one core idea that the past is never truly past. It lives within us. It's just always there. And this novel is his, well, his unflinching look at the mythology and the deep tragedy of the Old South, particularly how the legacy of slavery just poisons everything, even family.
Right. So our mission today for you listening is sort of like becoming literary detectives ourselves. We're following the clues alongside the characters in the book. We're trying to piece together the shattered story of the Sepin family. It's almost a ghost story, really, about the rise and the absolutely catastrophic fall of Thomas Sepin. And the whole thing starts for us, the readers, way later in 1909, seen through the eyes of this young student, Quentin Compson, who's deeply conflicted about it all.
And that whole rise and fall, that whole tragedy, it springs from one man's pretty ruthless ambition.
Oh, completely. The engine driving this whole narrative is Thomas Sepin. He shows up in Jefferson, Mississippi before the Civil War, this figure out of nowhere, and he has this single obsessive goal to create a dynasty. He actually calls it his design.
Yeah, the design.
Yeah.
And it's not just about getting rich, is it? It's about crashing the gates of the Southern aristocracy, forcing his way in.
You really have to understand where he came from to get why he's so driven, so ruthless about it.
Absolutely. His origin story is key. He grew up poor, a white kid from the mountains, totally outside that planter class. And his whole life, his whole ambition gets locked in by this one searing moment of humiliation. He gets churned away from the front door of a big plantation house.
Yeah.
By a black servant.
Wow.
And that rejection, that sudden brutal understanding that socially he was absolutely nothing, that becomes the fuel. His entire life becomes this cold, calculated climb towards respectability, which for him meant land, slaves, and, you know, the right connections.
A design built purely on calculation then. He arrives in 1833, almost materializes out of thin air, grabs this huge piece of land, Sepin's Hundred. He brings this French architect, and the book calls them wild slaves, to physically carve his ambition out of the Mississippi wilderness.
Yeah. And then the final piece. Marrying Ellen Coldfield, not for love, but because she's from a respectable, if declining, local family. It's a necessary social step for the design.
But the foundation is rotten from the start, isn't it? There's this huge moral compromise, this kind of original sin that guarantees the whole thing will eventually collapse.
Exactly. And it happens before he even gets to Mississippi. That's the crucial part. Sepin was married before, in Haiti, had a son, Charles Bond,
right.
But then he finds out his wife, and therefore his son, have black ancestry. And just like that, snaps fingers cold, immediate abandonment.
Yeah.
He just leaves them.
Just walks away.
Because his precious design, his fantasy of being a Southern patriarch, has to be racially pure, according to the twisted logic of the time.
Mm.
He chooses that abstract idea over his own wife and child.
That's chilling. A profound betrayal. But what's so interesting and so Faulknerian is how we learn about this. It's not laid out chronologically. We get it in fragments through unreliable memories. How does that structure work?
What makes you do the work, right?
Yeah.
The reader becomes complicit in trying to figure out the truth. The story doesn't just unfold neatly. It, like, piles up, layer upon layer. It starts in 1909 with Rosa Coldfield. She's Ellen's sister, now elderly, bitter, maybe a bit unhinged by it all. She tells her version to Quentin Compson, full of moral outrage, but also warped by her own trauma.
So her perspective is skewed from the start.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Then Quentin hears his father's version, or Mr. Compson's account, is more cynical, kind of detached, secondhand gossip almost.
Right.
And then the most fascinating part, I think, is Quentin up at Harvard in this cold dorm room with his Canadian roommate, Shreve. They're freezing. Thousands of miles away, decades later. And they're essentially trying to invent the missing pieces. Imagine the motivations, fill in the gaps of this Southern tragedy they've inherited.
Wow.
Faulkner's showing us that history isn't just a list of facts. It's objective. It's storytelling. It's this constant, maybe impossible attempt to reconstruct something broken.
It really is like literary archaeology, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sifting through these layers of memory and bias. And then, bam, Sepin's hidden past literally walks onto the stage. Charles Bond arrives.
Bond. The ghost in Sepin's machine. He's everything Sutpin should want in an heir, ironically. He's charming, educated, sophisticated, handsome, a bit mysterious.
And he shows up in Mississippi.
Yes, turns up at the university and almost immediately becomes best friends with Henry Sutpin, who is Sutpin's legitimate son and heir, the acknowledged
Back,
one.
the dramatic irony.
Exactly. And then he gets even more tangled. Bond gets engaged to Henry's sister, Judith Sutpin.
So the abandoned son is about to marry his own half-sister, and his best friend is his half-brother. But nobody knows the full truth except Sutpin.
Precisely, an absolute explosive
In
mix.
Henry's story, it's just agonizing. He starts as this golden boy, the heir apparent, but Bond's arrival throws him into this impossible moral conflict.
He seems to genuinely love Bond. There's real friendship there, camaraderie. He admires him. He wants him as a brother-in-law.
But
But he's also completely bound by the rigid codes of the South, the ideology of race and purity he's grown up with. He can't escape it.
so that tension just ratchets up. What happens when Sutpin finds out about the engagement?
Well, Tuppen knows exactly who Bond is, of course. He recognizes his son. But he can't acknowledge him because of the racial ancestry, that drop of black blood. So he forbids the marriage, absolutely forbids it. But crucially, he refuses to tell Henry why. He can't reveal the real reason, the racial impurity and the incestuous connection.
Leaving Henry completely baffled and torn.
Exactly. And this leads to the breaking point. Henry has to choose his father's inexplicable command or his loyalty and love for Bond and Judith.
And he chooses Bond.
He chooses Bond. He repudiates his father, his birthright, everything. And he and Bond go off together to fight in the Civil War, almost like escaping one kind of violence for another, putting the family drama on hold.
But war can't erase the past, can it? It just
Yeah.
delays the inevitable reckoning between Sutpin's secret and the brutal laws of the South.
Not at all. The war ends and the core conflict remains. And it's Quentin and Shreve piecing it together in that Harvard room who finally articulate the devastating truth Sutpin withheld.
What is that final revelation they uncover?
It's the core of the tragedy, really. They figure out, or perhaps deduce, maybe even invent, that Charles Bond isn't just Sutpin's abandoned son. He is his mixed-race son. He has African ancestry. And according to the South's one-drop rule, that makes him black. Legally, socially, irrevocably black.
Which means?
Which means he's deemed unfit to marry the white Judith, unacceptable as an heir to the Sutpin name and property, and, most horrifyingly, it confirms he is Henry and Judith's half-brother.
God. So Henry learns this.
The narrative suggests Sutpin finally tells Henry the truth. Maybe not the whole truth about the brotherhood, but certainly about the race aspect, likely just before the final confrontation.
Forcing Henry into this absolutely impossible choice. It's not about jealousy or inheritance anymore.
No, it becomes purely about race, about sacrificing his love for his friend, his loyalty, his own desires, everything, on the altar of this abstract concept of racial purity.
He's trapped between his humanity and this lethal social code.
Utterly trapped. And his choice defines the climax of the novel. He meets Bond at the gates of Sutpin's Hundred, the plantation Bond should have inherited. And he kills him, shoots him dead, fratricide, brother killing brother, driven not by personal hatred, but by the demands of a racist society.
To protect his sister from marrying a man deemed black and possibly from unknowingly marrying her own brother.
Yes, he prevents the marriage, upholds the racial boundary, preserves the family honor as he sees it. But in doing so, he destroys himself, destroys Bond, and effectively ends the Sutpin line right there.
And the title Absalom, Absalom, that biblical echo of King David crying out for his dead rebellious son, it just amplifies the sense of epic, inescapable doom.
It frames it as this timeless tragedy of fathers and sons, of ambition leading to ruin, but Faulkner roots it specifically in the poisoned soil of Southern race relations.
While the men are caught in this storm of ideology and violence, what about Judith? Judith Sutpin seems quieter, but her role feels really significant.
Judith is fascinating. She represents a kind of stoic endurance, maybe. After Bond is killed, she takes his body, arranges the burial herself. She doesn't collapse.
She holds it together.
She does. And significantly, she keeps Bond's letters, these fragments of their relationship, of his lost story. And later, she even takes in and cares for Bond's own son, Charles Etienne, who is also mixed race, and eventually his black wife.
So she becomes the keeper of the broken pieces.
In a way, yes,
Yeah.
a quiet resister. She maintains a practical dignity amidst all the destruction caused by the men's obsessions and violence. She doesn't let the story completely vanish, even if she can't fully grasp or articulate its meaning.
Let's shift gears slightly and talk about how Faulkner tells this story. The style is just as important as the plot, isn't it? You mentioned stream of consciousness. How does that feel for the reader?
Oh, it's intense. It can be overwhelming at first. Think of those incredibly long sentences, clauses piling on clauses, twisting back on themselves, sometimes going for pages.
Yeah, they're famous or infamous.
Right. They create this feeling of breathlessness, like you're inside someone's head while they're obsessively trying to figure something out, turning it over and
Not
over.
memory itself.
Exactly like memory. Messy, associative, not linear at all. The prose style is the theme. It embodies the idea that the past isn't neatly cordoned off. The violence, the betrayals, the desires of the 1830s are still echoing, still alive, and demanding attention in Quentin's mind in 1909. It feels simultaneous.
Like it's all happening right now. And the setting, the physical place, feels crucial too. Sutpen's Hundred, the mansion itself.
Definitely. The house is a massive symbol. Its creation is violent and fast, built by this imported architect and enslaved labor. It represents Sutpen's ambition made concrete.
Grand but artificial.
Totally artificial. It's not rooted in generations of tradition like the other plantations pretend to be. It's raw, new, imposed on the landscape, like Sutpen himself.
So its decay mirrors his failure.
Perfectly. As Sutpen's design unravels, the house falls into ruin. Its eventual burning at the end signifies the complete collapse of the corrupt dream it represented, a hollow grandeur built on exploitation finally consumed.
Which brings us right back to that central theme, the destructive force of racial ideology. Bond's tragedy isn't his fault. It's that society defines him in a way that destroys him.
Absolutely. The novel is a devastating critique of how an arbitrary social construct, that one drop of blood making you black, can override love, kinship, basic human connection. It turns brother against brother. It makes Sutpen value a flawed, abstract design over his actual son. It shows how racial ideology isn't just unjust, it's fundamentally dehumanizing, even for those who try to wield it.
And the tragedy doesn't stop with Bond's murder or the war, does it? Sutpen's dynasty just keeps crumbling.
It does. He comes back after the war, defeated but still obsessed. The mansion is decaying. His legitimate son, Henry, is a fugitive murderer. His wife, Ellen, is dead. Yet he still desperately tries to salvage the design. He needs a male heir.
How does he try to achieve that?
Oh, it's almost pathetic in its ruthlessness. First, he approaches Rosa Coldfield, his dead wife's sister, who has been living there. He basically proposes a trial run. If she can bear him a son, he'll marry her.
Just transactional.
Completely. She's horrified and leaves, actually. Then his final attempt involves Millie Jones, the young granddaughter of Wash Jones, a poor white squatter living on Sutphen's land.
Wash Jones, the man who admired Sutphen initially.
Yes, Wash initially saw Sutphen as this heroic figure, everything he wasn't. Sutphen gets Millie pregnant, clearly hoping for that elusive male heir,
Wow.
but she gives birth to a daughter. And Sutphen's reaction is utterly callous. He dismisses Millie and the baby girl with contempt, comparing them unfavorably to livestock. Just brutal indifference.
And Wash Jones overhears this.
He does. And that final insult, that absolute denial of Millie's humanity after everything, finally shatters Wash's illusions about Sutpen. He sees the so-called aristocrat for the monster he is.
And takes action.
He picks up a rusty scythe and kills Sutpen. The great designer, the would-be patriarch, cut down not in some grand battle, but in the dirt by a poor white man he despised, defending his granddaughter's dignity. The final ignoble end of the Sutpen dream.
A brutal end to a brutal story.
Yeah.
And Faulkner brings us back, in the final pages, to Quentin Compson, still wrestling with this legacy up north.
Yes, the ending is haunting. Quentin is telling the story, or part of it, to Shreve, who asks him why he hates the South. And Quentin's reply, almost a cry, is, "I don't hate the South. I don't hate it. I don't hate it."
That repetition.
It's pure psychological torment, isn't it? He's trapped. He can't simply condemn the place he comes from, the history that shaped him, but he also can't ignore its profound, inescapable guilt and corruption. He loves it and hates it and can't reconcile the two.
It leaves you with the sense of an ongoing burden, the weight of history on the present.
Definitely. And maybe at its heart, the novel is about the desperate need for recognition. Charles Bond just wanted his father to acknowledge him, right?
Yeah.
Just as a simple sign. But the social system, the racial hierarchy Sutpen embraced, made that impossible. It shows how these inherited structures, these ideologies, can corrupt love, deny dignity, and ultimately destroy people.
It's a novel that really forces you to grapple with the messy, painful complexities of history and how its shadows stretch across time.
It absolutely does. It reminds us that societal sins, especially those rooted in dehumanization, don't just disappear. They linger, they haunt, they demand confrontation across generations.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.